The primary focus of this service in general, as well as of my sermon specifically, is inviting us to reflect on the ways that we respond. How we respond when we or those we love experience tragedy, trauma, or loss. Although each individual and situation is different, there are some common lessons that can help in many, if not in all, situations. My hope this morning is to increase the likelihood collectively of our helping rather than unintentionally contributing to more injury or harm. But before I move directly into that larger point, I'd like to say just a little bit about why I chose to preach about this important topic now as opposed to some future date. As many of you know, I'm in the middle of a long and bureaucratic process of transferring my ministerial credentials from the liberal Christian denomination that I was a part of previously to full ministerial fellowship with the Unitarian Universalist Association. And that's essentially a process that, as far as I can see, takes at least 5 years, no matter who you are and what you do, and no matter how many, whether you've already completed your doctorate, etc. I'm currently moving toward the end of stage 3 of 5 of that process, and if you have a few hours to spare sometime, I can give you the details of what that means. The pertinent part is that the UUA required that I spend 100 hours this summer in a clinical pastoral education program. If some of you saw the promotion for this sermon on the website or in the newsletter, it was actually had CPE as the original title, and that's what CPE stands for, clinical pastoral education. And CPE is infamous in some clergy circles for supervisors that try to break down ministerial approaches to pastoral care in a very heavy-handed, top-down, hierarchical way. And then they try to build you back up after they've emotionally flayed you in front of your peer group. Fortunately, many CPE programs are kinder and gentler these days, including the one that I was enrolled in. And I suspect that those of you who have experienced trauma or loss and then had people unintentionally or obliviously say or do things that were actually harmful to you instead of helpful can maybe think of some people you'd like to require to spend 100 hours next summer in a clinical pastoral education setting to be more aware of the emotional impact of our words and actions. As the old saying goes, intention does not equal impact. Intention does not equal impact. In other words, even with the best of intentions, the impact of our words and deeds may unintentionally wound another for a confluence of reasons. The reason I didn't take CPE earlier was partially because I didn't have to and because I'd heard horror stories, and because my previous denomination allowed clergy to either do CPE or spiritual direction. And so I chose a 3-year program in the latter. And spiritual direction, if you're curious, according to one simple definition, involves 2 basic movements, awareness and response. Awareness and response. You seek to accompany another person in becoming more aware, more fully and deeply aware of all that's going on in their lives on various different levels, and then assist them in discerning how they feel called to move forward in light of that deepened and fuller awareness. And I bring this up because my experience in spiritual direction and CPE were so different. To be sure, 100 hours of CPE this summer was a long time. That's the equivalent of 2.5 40-hour weeks added on top of what I, you know, already do here every week. But that's a drop in the bucket compared to the three-year spiritual direction program I did from 2007 to 2009 when I had much more reading, many more papers to write, in which I spent 3 full weeks on campus each year in San Anselmo, California at San Francisco Theological Seminary. But whereas I loved almost every moment of that spiritual direction training, I found my CPE training to be, for the most part, very enervating and draining. In a joke that I worked out in conversation with UUCF member Steve Shatkin, for me, CPE was 30% helpful and 100% required. And I should add that I actually am serious about that 30%. I really did get some substantial, helpful insights and reminders in 30% of the program, but 70% I was bored out of my mind. And I will add that many of my ministerial and chaplaincy peers tell me that they've benefited immensely from CPE training. So part of it has to do with where it comes in your formation. I've also taught to volunteers at hospice and similar settings who have had, you know, careers in other things but chose to take one unit of CPE, which is what I did this summer, and found themselves really empowered by the CPE process to be a much more sympathetic, compassionate presence, how to really own what they're doing and being really aware of what's going on when they're in a room with someone who is suffering immensely or in immense pain. So even if you don't have a consideration of going into full-time ministry or a chaplaincy path, you might actually benefit from CPE at some point if you're drawn to that sort of work, or if people seem drawn to you to tell you their problems or seem comforted by your presence. And if that's the case, I'd be glad to talk with you about where and how to best take CPE to potentially have as positive an experience as possible. Now, that being said, my somewhat circuitous point for the last few minutes is that my CPE experience itself was a huge lesson in the truth that intention does not always equal impact. The intention of that UUA requirement and the CPE syllabus was that 100 hours this summer would be well spent and deeply impactful and meaningful to me. But the truth was, as I said earlier, it was about 30% helpful. More generally, most people's intent is to be 100% helpful. But sometimes you have to name for yourself that despite another person's best intention, that other person may only be a little bit helpful or even potentially harmful in their impact. It may or may not be helpful to name that for the other person. It depends on who they are and what your relationship with them is. But naming that truth, if only for yourself, can help you begin to identify what is and isn't helpful for you in your personal process of moving from tragedy and trauma and loss toward healing and wholeness, whatever that looks like for you in your life. Now, Megan shared earlier some about the harmful and the helpful interactions with others in the wake of her mother's death, and she could tell you many, many more stories, but I limited her to 5 minutes, and she did an excellent job of accomplishing an amazing amount in 5 minutes. And she was talking about, you know, what happened, how she, you know, coped with this when she and her twin sister were only 21 years old with her mother's death. And as many of you know, my father died of esophageal cancer a week before I turned 16. And during his illness, I remember one Sunday, my youth minister asked me in front of the entire youth group, "Carl, I heard your dad was going through some tests. Is there anything you want to share about that?" I was horrified. From what I recall, I mumbled something in response, but inside I felt really exposed and almost in shock. I just hadn't anticipated that question at all, certainly not being asked it in front of all my peers when I was still processing what I felt about my father's illness. And looking back, it would have been really helpful if we'd have talked to me beforehand, one-on-one, and even asked my permission about whether or not to share, instead of unexpectedly calling out a young teenager who already felt unsure and vulnerable. And the day my father died, one of the older high school leaders in the youth group and the associate pastor visited me that afternoon. And I would say they were good acquaintances at best. They were not good friends, and neither had visited during my dad's illness. The three of us had a fairly short meeting in my bedroom. It was fairly awkward. I remember having a slight feeling of hope when I answered the door and they were there that maybe they would have some wisdom for me, since I did respect them both as leaders in the congregation. But I mostly just felt relief when they finally left the room. That was the first and last conversation I had about either of them about my father's death. And the next day, another minister on staff came to visit our family, and I only remember one comment that he made during the conversation. He said, "Carl, you're the man of the house now." I was an only child. "You have to take care of your mother and grandmother." At not even age 16, I didn't even have an unrestricted driver's license, and I was certainly not ready to be the man of the house, nor would Dr. Freud have good thoughts about that. Nor was it my responsibility, and thankfully my grandmother overheard him saying that and later said to me directly that he was wrong and affirmed what I had already begun articulating for myself inside. And that's another lesson. There are times and places when it is appropriate to contend, either immediately or later, with advice that has been given by another to potentially help someone articulate for themselves that, at least for them, that might have been unhelpful advice for you. I'll also freely admit that although my intent personally is to be compassionately present in pastoral care situations, I'm not perfect, and there are times in the past, and surely there will be times in the future, when with 20/20 hindsight, as I'm driving away from a pastoral care situation, I can look back and realize that, you know, I probably should have said or done something differently. I'm only human, and that's one of the reasons that I follow the practice of many UU ministers of only meeting with someone for any given pastoral care situation no more than about 3 times maximum. So if you hear that from me, it's not personal. This actually is what I do with almost everyone, because I'm glad to meet with you or anyone about any situation or multiple different situations that arise in your life over time. But I also recognize that although I have advanced graduate training in pastoral care and counseling and spiritual direction, it's not what I do exclusively. It's not my full-time focus, you know, 40, 50, or 60 hours a week, which is why both myself and many UU ministers have a practice that if something can't be resolved in 1 or 2 or 3 meetings, you know, one particular problem, we'll typically refer you to a therapist or to a specialist in that particular area. And I would encourage all of you to do the same. If you find yourself in a situation where you really feel over your head, that you really don't know what to say or do as someone who is unable to cope by themselves with a particular situation, reach out to me. Reach out to a member of our pastoral care team so that we can potentially help refer them to me, or we can refer them to a therapist or a specialist, someone that has explicit training in that area. Now, that being said, I want to share with you just a few highlights from my CPE training this summer that you might find helpful in the future in being more compassionately present for friends, for family members, as well as in advocating for yourself in what is and isn't helpful for you when you are grieving or in pain. The first and most important touchstone is that each individual is the expert. Each individual is the expert in their own suffering, pain, and experience. No one can ever know the full extent of what you or another person is experiencing existentially, because we haven't walked in their shoes. We're not in their shoes right now. We don't know what's happened in the fullness of their life. To say more, it may be helpful to reference one of those books in our society that is frequently referenced, seldom understood, and even more rarely read. And I'm not talking about the Bible, though that could be the example. The example I'm talking about is psychiatrist Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's 1969 book on death and dying. This book is a classic example, and almost no one actually reads this book. We all think we know what it says. It's a classic example of intent not equaling impact. She had the best of intentions with that book, but some grief specialists argue today that it's unfortunately and unintentionally done more harm than good, due principally to a popular misunderstanding of Kubler-Ross's 5 stages of dying. In particular, the insistence that is sometimes made that a griever must go through all 5 stages and in precise order, or you're in denial or you're pathological. So, you know, denial, anger, bargaining, depression, acceptance, you've probably heard these stages. First of all, most people only know the 5 stages and haven't read the actual book, even the full title, which is On Death and Dying, What the Dying Have to Teach Doctors, Nurses, Clergy, and Their Own Families. In other words, the most important point of the book is not those 5 stages of dying, but a quite radical point back in 1969, when the modern hospice movement was still in its early stages, was that medical care should be reoriented toward the compassionate treatment of terminally ill people. So it used to be extremely focused to the medical side. That was the only thing that was important. We just need to let this person, you know, just let these doctors do whatever they want to do. So what she was really advocating, as hospice also advocated, was reorienting toward the terminally ill person. And not only what needs to be done to them, but what they can tell you about their experience and what also they have to teach and show us. As Kubler-Ross herself later emphasized decades later in her book On Grief and Grieving, she said, "The stages have evolved since their introduction, and they have been very misunderstood in the past 3 decades. They were never meant to tuck messy emotions into neat packages. They are responses to loss that many people have, But they are not a typical response to loss, as there is no typical loss. Our grief is as individual as our lives, and not everyone goes through all of them or goes through them in a prescribed order. An important corollary to this dictum that each individual is the expert in their pain, suffering, and experience is to give yourself permission to be comfortable when you're in the presence of someone suffering or in pain. Give yourself permission to be in that place of not knowing, what Buddhists call beginner's mind. Be okay with that, of letting go, of not knowing what the right thing to say is, or not knowing what the right thing to do is, and simply be compassionately present to the other person and let them lead you and name for you what they need to the extent that they can. Many times it's enough to just patiently listen and to say aloud just how much you care, and be willing sometimes even just to sit silently with someone who at the moment would rather not be alone. In my spiritual direction training, we used to say that one of the goals was simply to listen another person into speech. To listen another person into speech. That is, by listening attentively, compassionately, with our full self, and without judgment, we can create a space in which a person may find themselves articulating truths about their experience and their grieving process that they might not otherwise have done if you hadn't slowed them down enough to create that listening space. And by listening compassionately, we can actually be a catalyst in another person moving more rapidly toward healing and wholeness. I sometimes try to keep the advice of the Buddhist teacher Thera Brach in mind in such situations, that we should listen from a place of radical acceptance. To listen from a place of radical acceptance. And then in so doing, we'll unconsciously, if we really are opening ourselves up and radically accepting whatever is said, we may find ourselves unconsciously giving others permission to share from a place of inner freedom. Relatedly, one of the most common impulses in our society when we're faced with someone else's pain or tragedy is to say, "I'm so sorry that happened to you. I'm so sorry that happened to you." I know that I have said that reflexively sometimes and probably will again in the future. But instead of just generically saying that you're sorry, that you feel sorry for someone, it may be more helpful just to name the emotion that you're feeling about the situation. Just name that emotional elephant in the room. Name how shocked you are, how sad or how angry you are. And that may give the other permission to articulate how they're feeling as you resonate with them on an emotional level. Along these lines, I'd say that maybe the single most helpful section of reading that I did this summer for CPE was by a man named Jack Bloom. He's a practicing psychologist, and he spent 10 years as a congregational rabbi. This particular essay began with a list of some of the most unhelpful responses. I suspect some of you have heard these. These potentially harmful responses include, "Don't feel bad," "I know how you feel," "Replace it," "Grieve alone," "Time heals," "You must be strong," "Keep busy," and everyone's personal favorite, "It was God's will." Many of these responses seek to skip past messy emotions, and that's a recipe for later problems with what psychologists call repression, where things get repressed in the short time and then come back in a crooked, different way later that's much harder to deal with and identify. So in place of these potentially harmful responses, the author of this article recommends the following. First, just begin by asking, "What happened?" And let the person tell you in their own words. And then listen compassionately and without judgment or interruption. Though also give the person permission not to rehearse their story if they're just exhausted from doing so, or if that's just inculcating the pain. Second, as said earlier, name the emotional elephant in the room. You must feel so crushed, devastated, overwhelmed, heartsick, heartbroken, exhausted, painful, confused, drowning, trapped, scared, sad, lost, abandoned, numb, surprised, relieved, whatever is the case. Finally, in summary, he says, the very best thing you can say to grievers, or many grievers, is tell me a story about your loved one. And the very best thing you can do for many grievers is to give them a hug. Now, I have no doubt this morning that there are those of you who are present who would disagree with both of those and say that isn't helpful in my grief. But remember that first rule from earlier. Bloom may have a PhD in psychology and a decade of experience as a congregational rabbi, but you are the expert in your own pain, your own suffering and experience. And to speak briefly on behalf of pastoral caregivers, we do the best we can, but again, we're only human. If you can, and to the extent you are able, let us know not just when we get it wrong in offering pastoral care, but more importantly, how we might be more compassionately present to you and others like you in the future. For now, I'll end with these words. In whatever happens to you in this life, be gentle with yourself, with all that you are, with all that has happened to you, and all that you feel. Be gentle and take good care. Care of yourself, care of those you love, and with all that you meet. In the precious time that we have in this life and on this one earth, may we learn to freely choose loving kindness, patient listening, and fierce compassion. May it be so, and blessed be.